This is Summer Grandstand on ABC Sport.
Well, amidst the backdrop of this Ashes series, of course, it is Big Bash time. We're getting towards the business end of that. And in fact, it's been a busy time for a lot of these T20 so-called franchise leagues. Not just here, but I speak of New Zealand. There was also the ILT20 in the Emirates as well recently, and in South Africa, where there's a lot of buzz about the SA20 competition, now in its fourth year. And globally, it's developing quite a footprint and a lot of influence, to the point that a lot of objective observers say, hey, the SA20 is actually better than the Big Bash in Australia, or if not now, it soon will be. And maybe you don't really care about the Big Bash or T20 cricket. Now, I know a lot of you out there are test match purists, and I love and respect that, but make no mistake, it all has its place in a bigger conversation about the coexistence of every format, the financial health of the game overall, and certainly in South Africa, who are the reigning World Test champions, currently ranked second, number two behind Australia, but where they've implemented this T20 competition with the backing of foreign interests. They prioritise having their best players available for the domestic T20 league, and yet are still a very strong red ball team that Australia will actually meet in its next away tour in October. So I want to talk about all of that, and to help me do that, I'm delighted to say that South African writer and broadcaster, one of our grandstand favourites, Neil Manthorpe, has joined me on Summer Grandstand. Neil, appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, Brett.
I feel like this is a bit of a know your enemy, or at least know your rival. Not that we're enemies, but because I've seen more and more comparisons about our respective T20 leagues, and the Big Bash, to be fair, has seen strong crowds and TV numbers this year in Australia. But I look at the comparative rosters. I see names like Rashid Khan, James Vince, guys that we were used to seeing here in Australia, and now thinking, okay, this is where some players are preferring to go and play. And we have similar cricket conditions in our two countries, similar weather. And in fact, even our finals of these competitions are on the same weekend, which is 2 weeks from now. And everyone says the vibe there is good and everyone locally has really embraced the SA20 this year. Just give us an idea of the tangible success of the competition. And does it feel like it's even bigger this year?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, look, it started very, very strong. It had a massive marketing budget. It started from ground zero as well, if you remember. And there was, you know, South Africa had had two failed attempts to have a domestic T20 league. And they took as a starting point the old premise that the English Premier League had, which was fill the stadiums. That's your, if we fill the stadiums, everything else will follow. And so they bundled tickets. They sold them very, very cheaply. They weren't interested in gate money at all. They just wanted the spectacle. They knew that all of the big revenue would come from television, sponsorship, marketing, advertising, if they could just fill the stadiums. And that's what they did. And it's, you know, into the fourth year now, the stadiums are full. They're never full for any other game at any other time of year, international or domestic. And it's been very, very successful. And in Graham Smith, they've got a commissioner who understands what players enjoy. And obviously they enjoy playing in front of big crowds, but he's been very, very clever behind the scenes. He's ensured that it's a really, really popular event for particularly the married players with families. He's gone out of his way to make sure that they've got great accommodation, great facilities. It's a really, you know, it's a good time of year to bring the families over. And that's, you know, I think, it's, and also the money's pretty good, to be honest. Mm. So as a player, South Africa's, it's a great venue, and it's a little bit more convenient for most of them to get here with no time difference. Well, so, from England anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So if they're initiated, six teams in the SA20, all of them owned by foreign interests, is that right? So the likes of MI Cape Town, which is the Mumbai Indians conglomerate, Durban Super Giants, Sunrisers Eastern Cape, these all share names with Indian Premier League teams. And so the influence there is obvious. And the comp itself is, I think, minority owned as well, with CSA having a slight majority stake along with Supersport, the broadcaster, and presumably presumably, I guess, this assures that there is an ongoing commercial gain for CSA, that they haven't just sort of sold their soul for one quick sugar hit, and that ideally there's a sustainable financial windfall for the local governing body.
Yeah, all six teams are IPL. I mean, you know, it's no... Let's not beat about the bush. It is a mini IPL. It is completely and utterly dependent on the IPL. It just wouldn't exist without the IPL. And yes, there is an ongoing income. The franchises, by global terms, certainly in terms of the sale of the 100, which you know totaled I think close to 500 million pounds. We're talking absolute peanuts, sir, because there was nothing to sell. I mean, if you compare the money that the Big Bash might get if they sold minority interests or even, you know, sold the league, you're talking about a lot more money. There was nothing to sell. So, you know, even people who work in the world of finance find it quite difficult to keep up. There's a lot of cloak and dagger about the deals. But we're talking pretty small. I mean, the six IPL franchises bid in the region of $3 million as a down payment. But it's an ongoing situation, as you say. The Cricket South Africa own 57%, but they have, I mean, it's a nominal number. They have no control. Theoretically, they can say, well, we'd like you to do this, we'd like you to do that. But the IPL teams basically own the league because they own the teams, and there would be no teams without them. And there would be no income without the broadcaster of SuperSport. So, CSA have the cosy reassurance on paper of 57% ownership, but in effect they don't control it. They're a very very much hands off type situation, and you and I would know, Brett, even as humble sports journalists, that when it comes to divvying up the dividends, there are always expenses to be taken into account. And you can make your minority shareholding. If you hold the power, you can make sure that you also take the greater part of the dividends once the accounts have been done.
I remember, Neil, earlier in the previous World Test Championship cycle when South Africa picked a new-look test team, seven debutants, a new captain, because the idea was they had a tour of, I think, New Zealand during the same time as the SA20, and they had to have their best players, their biggest name test players available for the T20 League. And it only makes their achievement in becoming World Test Champions even more impressive, obviously, because those guys came back and they had a great cycle there. And obviously, their first-choice team, captained by Bavuma, and featuring the likes of Jansen, Rabada, is a very good one. But is this simply the way it's going to be? Is there a chance this happens again with future tours and who ultimately has the biggest say in what sort of test team is picked?
The SA20 is top of the pyramid. And so to think that it won't happen again would be naive. Perhaps not with the test team, but the next big situation is looming. In 12 months' time, the Future Tours program shows that England are due to tour South Africa for a multi-format tour with three test matches, three one-dayers and three T20s. Now, at the moment, the test matches won't be a problem because that's going to be middle of December and then South Africa's traditional Boxing Day and New Year test matches, and then the SA20 is scheduled for straight after that. At the same time as the three ODIs and three T20s are scheduled in January and into February. England has said that they can't reschedule. South Africa has said, well, we're playing the SA20, and there's an impasse at the moment. So it looks likely, most likely, that those six white ball internationals will be, inverted commas, postponed and then just cancelled because the SA20 takes precedence and is the pinnacle of the South African calendar. So to think that it won't keep happening would be naive. Some people think, well, the Indians are just money bags. You know, the IPL's got loads and loads of money, billions of dollars. And wouldn't it be nice to have some of that? And, you know, you can come along and have naming rights to a couple of our teams. No, they pay a lot of money, and they are businessmen, and they will get a return on their investment. And you know, South Africa is paying a price. Fans are loving it. They're loving they're loving the show, and yeah, they don't mind the fact that Mumbai Indians, Cape Town, and the Sunrisers and the Super Giants and Super Kings, and you know, it's just a name after all.
And this is why we're having this conversation, because I think if the privatisation of at least some BBL teams here in Australia is inevitable, which most of us believe it is, what does that look like? How does that change the landscape here? And it might well be, for an obvious one, that if someone starts pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into the Big Bash or into the Sydney Sixers, for example, that person will say, I expect Steve Smith to play every game. And all of a sudden, the entire schedule could change. I don't think they would move the test matches necessarily, though I understand that's the dystopian worst-case scenario for test match purists here. But would they contemplate shifting the BBL window so that it starts after the test? Because we have, of course, like you have, the Boxing Day, the New Year's test, very sort of big marquee events in test cricket. Shifting the BBL window so it goes into February again, like it used to when it was longer. That way, all those big name players are available. It's just one example of how the influence there will come in when the money comes in as well. I guess, how is South Africa's Red Bull team managed to be so successful while this shift has gone on? Is that an entirely separate conversation for an entirely separate format?
It's a fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's an alignment of stars and planets that is not likely to happen again in the future. I mean, there's, you know, they're a young team. They're adaptable. They're flexible. It's remarkable. I mean, you know, in this test cycle, they went to the Caribbean, they went to Bangladesh. Not even a thought of a warm up game. In fact, they only had 4 days of training, 4 days of nets. But they are so focused on playing test cricket. They're absolutely passionate about playing test cricket. And the other thing is, Brett, to say is because South Africa plays so little of it, they can afford to put everything, every, you know, moment of hard work and passion and a determination into playing it. I mean, you know, South Africa played 12 test matches in 2 years leading up to the World Test Championship final. If it wasn't for the World Test Championship, the long format would be dead in South Africa. It just wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be worth the players playing it. And as for all its kind of gross imperfections, the World Test Championship, you know, has to be one of the least credible international tournaments leagues ever, if you consider how many, you know, everyone plays different number
uneven,
of games,
yeah,
and they all play each other. I mean, it's preposterous, but it has kept the game alive in South Africa. And the current group of players who play test cricket regard it as the absolute pinnacle, you know, no question about it whatsoever. But they're not playing again. They're, you know, we won't have had a test match at home for a year and a half, well, 16 months. And they play so little of it that they can afford to be sort of pushed around and go, okay, well, we've got two test matches in October next, you know, so we can afford to forget about it and put it on the back burner. And then when it does come around, it'll only be, you know, 2 weeks out of our lives. So let's give it everything.
Speaking with writer and broadcaster Neil Manthorpe here on Summer Grandstand on ABC Sport about, I guess, the general landscape of cricket in South Africa right now. And, yeah, I sort of do think, well, how seriously is South Africa taking test cricket when they weren't even hosting a test series here this summer? For those that don't know, all the major grounds are getting redeveloped, I guess, for the 2027 One-Day International World Cup. Surely the overall interest in test cricket takes a hit if you're essentially having a summer off, and is that why the SA20 has been so big?
Brett, there will be long-term repercussions about not having a test match in South Africa for, you know, for 16 months. Of course there will be. But the current administration regard test cricket, it by and large, it loses money. You know, Australia are coming at the end of the year, and they'll manage to make some money out of that, and they make money out of India tours and England tours. But by and large, Test cricket is a complete inconvenience. And first-class cricket in South Africa, I honestly believe, will become irrelevant to the point where it is scrapped in the next five years. That you know, they will literally kill the roots to Test cricket, because at the moment, Cricket South Africa, they have a new breed of administrator that is very much financially practical, if you like. That's a kind way of putting it. But at the moment, they say, why have we been spending money for the last 30 years promoting first-class cricket when almost nobody comes to watch it? So the logical conclusion is, any money spent on this is a waste of money, so let's not bother. So first-class cricket is not marketed at all. Nobody knows it's happening. It's a kind of starvation process whereby provinces won't be able to afford to play Test cricket. Won't be able to afford to play first-class cricket. And the home audiences see so little of it that it won't become their priority. It is, I tell any cricket-loving South African at the moment, enjoy Test cricket. Enjoy the fact that this team are World Test champions, because I cannot see a way that it will happen again or survive into the future.
Of course, as you mentioned, Australia is touring there in October of this year. That's right, it's 2026. Australia only plays two Test matches in the next little while. We don't play one until Bangladesh comes here in 7 months from now and plays here in August in two Tests. Then it's Australia's first tour of South Africa since 2018. I'm not sure if you remember this, Neil, but last time we were there, something happened. Some guys got caught with sandpaper. Occasionally it gets mentioned every now and then. How big will that Test series be for the host nation?
It'll be absolutely enormous. You mentioned a couple of names there, Marco Jansen, Kagiso Rabada, Themba Bavuma. I mean, playing against Australia and England, and England are coming at the end of the year as well. It's going to be a massive, massive Test summer. And I shouldn't speak on behalf of the players, but I can tell you that many of them are regarding it, not necessarily willingly. You know, all of them are regarding it as potentially the best, the pinnacle of their Test careers, because they don't know what the future holds. They work for administrators that their bosses don't really care about first-class cricket, and Test cricket is very much secondary in their priority list, or third or fourth. So it's a massive, massive summer. Marco Jansen's still only 27 years old, and he's thinking, this is the biggest summer of my Test career, and it probably won't ever happen again. And so they're really hugely gearing up for it. And if they can, get themselves into another World Test Championship final, And it was such a massive occasion at Lord's for all of them. Coach Shuki Conrad said afterwards, even if we don't qualify for the next final, I'm going to be here. There will be nothing disappointing or low key or anticlimactic about this Test summer. And I certainly hope that Australia are up for it. I'll be watching the Ashes very keenly, and delighted to hear Mitch Stark say that he's still up for it and lead the attack. So I reckon, talking about pinnacles of Test careers, I hope that the Australian team can sort of all hang on and hang in there together. I know a lot of them are into their mid or late 30s, but I can't wait for September, October.
Well, it's a big year coming up for them as well. Our three biggest away tours, South Africa, India, England, all in the space of 12 months. So it's massive for all those guys. I think they'll hang on for potentially all of those, the players you mentioned. Just in the more immediate future, Neil Manthorpe, the T20 World Cup squad for South Africa, of course, for a long time it was noted that the Proteas were always very good semi-finalists at World Cups. Didn't used to get beyond there. They finally did that in 2024, runners-up, of course, beaten by India. But somehow here in the upcoming tournament, they've named a 15-man squad, and all your favourites are there. Aiden Markram, the captain, Quinton de Kock, Marco Janssen, Kahiso Rabada, Lungi Ngidi, and those guys, Enric Norkia. But somehow seven players are appearing at their first World Cup. So nearly half the squad has changed from just barely 18 months ago. How do we make sense of that?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah, there's no Ryan Rickleton. Tristan Stubbs has been a mainstay across all three formats for the last couple of years. But I mentioned Coach Shukri Conrad, and he... I don't suppose he's any different to any other coach. They've got their favourite players. They've got their set ideas. Tony DeZorzi, he's a Western Cape Town boy, as is Shukri Conrad. So I think that he's a bit of a left field wild card selection. He's very good in subcontinental conditions, but has only played a couple of T20 internationals. So there are some interesting selections. Jason Smith is another Cape Town boy. He's 31 years old. And so, the cricket people are looking and going, well, there's another Shukri pick. It's interesting, really, isn't it? I mean, Australia have a far more, I think, robust selection system with a selection panel, a convener of selection in George Bailey. I think he's done a tremendous job. And so it is far less parochial in Australia. But you know what? I mean, the T20 World Cup comes around every 2 years, doesn't it? And I just think that that we see evidence of the fact that it has been diluted quite significantly. We see evidence everywhere. Lachie Ferguson and Matt Henry, I don't know whether you saw this, when New Zealand cricket announced their squad, there was a beautiful line in there which said, the partners of Henry and Ferguson are both expecting children during the T20 World Cup, so it's quite likely that they will be given paternity leave. Which I thought, it's a long way to go to cut the umbilical cord. And I don't think that they would necessarily have been thinking that if the T20 World Cup was every 4 years. But yeah, I mean, South Africa have made a couple of sort of boldish moves. I think on the basis that, well, if it goes wrong, we'll be able to do it all again in Australia and New Zealand in 2 years' time.
Neil Manthorpe, great to chat. We always appreciate your time here on the ABC. And if not before, we'll see you or hear from you in October.
Look forward to it. Can't wait.
This is Summer Grandstand on ABC Sport.